Okay, I'm sitting here around my dining room table with David Malky and Ryan North, webcomics celebrities, celebutants, webutants? I don't know.
Dilettantes. Like
that. Dilettantes. Dilettantes. That's the right excellent. Word. There we go. So, yeah, they put out a book a little while ago called Machine of Death, which, if you haven't heard of it, is a collection of short stories all generating around a kind of original kind of premise.
A shared premise.
A shared premise, yeah. And maybe you could jump in and tell.
Sure. It comes from a comic I wrote about 5 years ago where I do a comic called Dinosaur Comics, and this was the T-Rex talking about it. And the premise is it's a machine that it takes a little sample of blood, you run through the machine, and a piece of paper gets spat out with how you're going to die on it. And it doesn't tell you when, but it tells you how. Let's say it says old age. And the twist of the narratives, or the nature of the machine, is that old age could mean you die, you know, sleeping around with a smile on your face, or it could mean octogenarian falls asleep at the wheel and smashes into you, or those old age can mean a lot. And so you have this flexibility in that the machine tells you how you're going to die, but doesn't actually tell you
the circumstances.
Yeah, and there's still surprises to be had. And the stories that we collected sort of explored that, different ways people react to it, to how society reacted.
Right. The idea was, if this machine existed, if you could learn from just a blood sample how you will die, how does the existence of that machine change the world?
Right.
And so that was the prompt that we provided, and we had an open submission process where we invited people to write stories on this theme, using that as a starting point. And we received...
That's your coffee.
Awesome.
How do you take your coffee?
Cream or milk would be great. But we received 675 stories on this theme, and from those we picked our favorite 30, in addition to 4 that we wrote, Ryan and myself and our other editor, Matt. And so we had a book of 34 stories, all starting from that one premise, but going in very different directions.
Tons of different directions.
Yeah. So some of the stories are funny, some are tragic, some are serious, some are lighter, and it's a very, very diverse collection of stories.
Yeah, and I think largely in thanks to the huge pool of stuff that came in. So can you maybe talk a little bit about that submission call? I mean,
sure.
I'm sure there's like, tons of places that are like kind of totally jealous of that kind of response in terms of like getting a pick of that kind of magnitude.
Yeah, we didn't know. We sort of just decided to do this and didn't really know what we were doing for a lot of things. And so for the call, we just told people on our websites
that
you can submit stories.
And we lucked out because, I mean, the reason we decided to turn this particular dinosaur comic into a book was the fact that people who read it on their own started to come up with crazy ideas around it. And so it was
seemed like a fertile prompt just by accident.
The community on Brian's forum responded to it instantly and just started tossing around ideas, and it was really compelling.
And it's exciting to me, this idea of like floating these ideas, like not obsessing over like the perfect idea, just like floating a bunch of ideas, and hey, that really, people are really super excited about that.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm interested in kind of hearing that. I know Ryan's kind of got a daily schedule, and you're not.
Well, my comic strip is twice weekly.
Twice weekly.
Yeah, so it's still regular.
Right. Right.
And I have a lot of, like Ryan, I mean, we both have like a lot of other side projects and different creative ideas. I have personally a extraordinary tendency to want to make things bigger and more complicated than necessary.
Okay.
I'm unsatisfied with something that's not unwieldy.
Okay.
And there's a weird like
Baroque kind of aesthetic or something.
I have a weird perfectionism where I have to like something has to be tweaked in every detail before I'm happy with it. And in a way that's crippling, because it takes forever to do anything.
Right.
But the good news is when something does finally fire off, it is usually pretty satisfying.
Right, right.
And it doesn't always work, of course. And that's why I'm a huge proponent of the, you know, less talk, more rock idea of just doing stuff. Because I'm well aware of the danger that can come about from obsessing over things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm always trying to find the balance between stop worrying, just do. Mm-hmm. Stop reworking. I invented a phrase. It's like you can fall into a habit of making shoes for a mermaid.
Okay.
Where it's something that you think would be awesome, but is unnecessary.
Yes.
And, you know, I think there's a real balance between something that is dashed out and you don't care about it, and on the other end, something that's obsessed over so much that it never, ever happens.
Uh-huh.
And there's a sweet spot right in the middle where you can craft something cool, but you get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing I'm always sort of circling over trying to land on, is that middle spot.
Right, right.
And I'm really happy that so far Machine of Death turned into, you know, it was a long process. It mm-hmm. was years in the making, mm-hmm. and it felt like it was going to be one of those latter things that you're in that pattern of when are we going to do it, when are we going to do it, when's it going to happen. And part of it was, you know, we were able to get interest from different publishers, and we thought this was a strong enough idea that it had legs in a sort of a mainstream way, mm-hmm. and we wanted to get it in front of, you know, the biggest possible audience. And so we would embark on these crazy runs of, you know, A leads to B leads to C leads to D leads to this agent finally reading it.
Yeah,
and they'd string us along for a long
yeah,
time.
Yeah, and then it would be like 6 months later, we'd finally hear back. It's like, you know, it turns out XYZ, we can't do this. And it's like, all right, back to the starting gate. And we did that. I mean, this is something I can't often say, but I am reasonably certain that we exhausted every possible avenue with Machine of Death. And there's a lot of other things where it's perfectly fine to cut it short and say, you know what, it's tough. Here is fine.
Right.
But for this one, we ran it to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And every possible avenue every connection we had. And over the course of the several years, we got more successful. You know, we started out as these guys with websites who were doing okay.
Uh-huh.
And then over the 3 years later, we were more successful than we were 3 years previous, and we had more connections and ability and networks than we had 3 years previous, and so we exhausted all those new connections. And and by the end of it, what we learned was we were proficient in this business enough that we didn't need the other people.
Right.
And that was something that we learned, or we figured out about halfway through, but still wanted to chase down all these rabbit trails.
Right, right.
By
right.
the end of it, we were just like, well, it's led us to relying on ourselves, which is what we eventually did.
Right, right.
Which worked out great.
It turned out in a very surprising and gratifying way.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's an inspiring kind of story because, I mean, it's funny. I had my sort of publishing history is that I self-published books and zines and stuff for years, and then published my first full-length novel with HarperCollins, and that was fine in a number of ways, and they considered it successful and stuff. And I just was never comfortable with the corporate ownership of HarperCollins, and so I decided to sort of start going back to publishing my own books with the same kind of mentality of like, okay, well, I know how to do all this stuff, and I know that what they're offering on some levels is not sort of black magic voodoo.
They're, yeah, right. You know, yeah.
So I was able to get a distribution kind of situation set up, and it ended up, my second book ended up selling it better than my first one,
yeah.
Which is, yeah. So, you know, and so for me, it's always a case of figuring out, okay, well, what model works for you?
Yeah.
And a lot of people would say to me, for instance, like, well, your second book never would have sold as well if you hadn't had that first exposure through HarperCollins,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if you guys have had a similar kind of response in terms of your...
I mean, my getting it published, a lot of the things we were hearing was that, you know, this is, we like the book, but it's science fiction, it's an anthology, there's no name authors, no one's going to buy this. And it became clear that the people who most believe in the book were ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's nice to bring that sort of enthusiasm to the project. And then
mm-hmm.
when it came time to launch it, we picked a day, I think it was at random.
It was, the day was determined by when the proofs were ready.
Yeah. So, which we thought, all right, we'll pick this day and we'll ask everyone, our readers, if you want to buy the book, buy it this day.
Right.
Off Amazon. And it turns out that was a really bad day to pick because Tuesday was when everyone dropped their new books.
Okay.
But over that course of the day, in a couple hours, we went to the top of Amazon's best-selling book list.
Mm-hmm.
We were
mm-hmm.
right there, and we accidentally beat out a lot of actual traditionally published books,
right,
who were sort of banking on that number one spot. We beat them sort of by accident and started these grudge fights by accident.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a success that was heavily fueled by the sort of David and Goliath story, mm-hmm. I think, because we told everyone. I mean, one thing we've really tried to do with this process is be transparent with everybody who's participated and who's been following the story and say,
over 5 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's like, look, we're just some guys putting out a book, and here's what we've learned, and here's what we think might work, and here's what hasn't worked, and here's what we hope will. And the 6 days before, like, once I was confident that the books would be ready, and I actually had to push, my initial day was 10-10-10 was my idea. And they were just, books weren't ready. We had to go to the 26th. And I said, let's look, everybody, here's what we're doing. Mm-hmm. I think it was the 20th. It was 6 days before. I said, this book is finally done.
Mm-hmm.
You've been following it for years. Here's what's happened in the interim. We've shopped it to all these publishers. We've had all these agents interested. And these agents, people who liked it. And mm-hmm. they were just like, we just cannot sell this book.
Right.
No one will buy it.
Yeah.
And so we decided that we want to kind of prove something in a way.
Uh-huh.
Not that we have a grudge, but like you said, there's a huge perception that the things that quote-unquote professionals do
mm-hmm.
is impossible for anyone else to do.
Right.
It's the right way to do it.
It's the right way, yeah, mm-hmm. in all capital letters. And there's some merit to that, because for a lot of years, there was no alternative. And there's also a really, really tempting view that authors and artists and cartoonists have, that is, I should be able to just be the artist and let someone else do all the yucky stuff.
Sure.
And
dirty their hands with the money.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I've talked to friends of mine who are writers, and very, nobly, they've said, I don't like doing that thing. I'm not, like, the marketing and everything, I'm not good at it, and the more I do that, the less time I have to write. All that stuff is totally true.
Mm-hmm.
It's also totally true that, you know, the moon is beautiful and I would love to walk on it. But it doesn't mean I should be able to do it.
Right.
You know, there's just facts in the world
mm-hmm.
that will prevent you. And so, like you said, I also want to caution against a way of thinking that is all or nothing in
mm-hmm.
either direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are certainly very, very severe limitations that have come about because of our sort of self-publishing thing. Like, we're never going to be on Oprah, you know, we're never, you know, whatever. Well, her show's in. Anyway, the point is. And,
we're definitely never going to be on.
Yeah, oh, we missed our chance.
This whole book was to get on Oprah.
Yeah.
It's ruined.
You know, like, there's compromises. And the benefit to that is that there is no, the only, like, there's no one keeping score, really. The only person who can decide what's right or wrong is yourself, and what your goals are for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have, in fact, cultivated a very unusual hybrid approach that involves traditional distribution into bookstores all across North America. It involves having the book available on every website that sells books around the world, really. And yet we are self-publishers,
mm-hmm.
and yet we are taking the financial risk ourselves,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, we are sending out review copies to magazines that never bothered to open the package, and you're doing all the things that traditional publishers do as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not about being a self-publisher who does print on demand and never is able to, you know, never has to dirty their hands with a print run of books that you know, has to be shipped. Like, there's a lot of easy ways to do it, you know, sort of in new ways now. And there's a real self-publishing mantra that's like, you don't need anybody. And we've decided that, you know what, it helps to have some allies. The people who are most successful selling books as books of webcomics are people who print books for $2 and sell them for $20.
Mm.
And you only have to sell 10% as many or fewer than you would from a traditional publisher.
Right.
And so it's about cultivating a relationship with a dedicated, but even if small, audience,
mm-hmm.
and selling them things that cost more money.
Right.
And it's the 1,000 true fans idea.
Mm-hmm.
And so by going the traditional distribution route, we have limited the amount of money we can make from those sales mm-hmm. for the trade-off of exposure. Mm-hmm. And then we play the gamble that the increased sales volume makes up for that difference.
Right, right.
And it's been super interesting to look at the sales numbers that come back from the distributor and to see a number that represents the gross sales to the bookstores
right.
and watch that number get funneled down through returns and mm-hmm. charges and shipping
yeah.
and agents' commissions and this and this and this
yeah.
and this and this and this. And yeah. it's like, at the bottom, it's like, here's your check. And it's like, really?
Yeah.
This is the business?
This is the business? Exactly. And then you go one step further and there's another huge red number that says, Borders will never pay its bill. And you just are, that's just the world that we live in.
Yeah, yeah, we had the great timing guys. Where Borders went bankrupt right after we shipped them our load of books.
Yeah, we sent them 2,000 books.
Okay.
We did this thing where we became the number one best-selling book on Amazon. And all the publishers and agents and everyone who pay attention to that sort of thing were trying to get a hold of us on that day. Like, our email inbox is filled up. And they were all saying either, who are you and what are you doing? Or, we Googled you, we know what you're doing, this is amazing. Some of the same people who had passed the book the first time were writing us back saying, maybe we were hasty.
Right, right.
We got emails from Amazon, too.
Yeah, well, we got emails from people at Amazon saying, we are watching this thing happen from within, and like, what can we do to help you?
Wow.
Like, you know, there was one lady who was very nice about it, but we weren't writing back to people right away because we didn't know what to do.
Right.
But she, when she didn't hear back from us via the Machine of Death email address, she wrote probably to Ryan. She found Matt on LinkedIn, sent a message there. She found my office phone number. So she was very persistent. She ended up being very nice and helpful in the days to come. We got emails from Amazon, from people at Barnes & Noble saying, how do we order your book?
Right.
From people at translation agencies saying, can we hear about your book so that we can shop it to foreign, you know, other publishers?
Right, right,
From agents saying, we can now help you get a deal with a publisher
right.
based on this. which is, you know, not an unfair thing to suppose someone would want. You know, from publishers saying, hey, we'd love to know who you guys are and maybe read this book. And
right, which is right. really gratifying after 5 years of hearing no.
For yeah. sure. Yeah, yeah.
yeah. So we had to figure out what we wanted to do.
Right.
And so I realized that there was one agent in particular that had been a big champion of the book and had just been unable to do anything with it.
Right.
But he was someone that I had met in person, I trusted,
mm-hmm.
who knew my work. And I'd rather talk to him than anybody coming in for the first time,
right?
You know, smelling success.
Yes.
So I called him up. It's actually kind of a funny conversation. I said, PJ, it's David. And he says, hi. And I go, big news. And he goes, yeah. And I go, oh, you've heard. And he goes, no. And I go, Machine of Death is number one on Amazon. And he goes, what? And I hear click, 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 click. David, this is incredible. How did you do it? And I said, we asked people to buy it, and they did. And I told him, I'm like, where do we go from here? Mm-hmm. Like, we have these weird offers coming in, and he's like, let me make some calls.
Right.
And by the end of the day, he's like, you know, what do you want to do? Because mm-hmm. now we have options.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to stay as the publisher and sort of try and get distribution into bookstores?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where do you want to go from here?
Mm-hmm.
And so we had kind of a decision to make.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, what we decided was that we had given everyone else their chance, mm-hmm. and we were going to do it ourselves.
Sure.
For good or for ill. You
right,
know?
Right.
We were at least going to try it. We right. were going to go the next step.
Mm-hmm.
And so we signed a deal to get the book into bookstores. I mean, that was, you know, it took a little bit of time. We had to call the printing company that was about to do, you know, run more books off the press and say, hold the press, like, make this order much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
The people at the distribution company had to get on board and talk to their sales agents who deal with the chains and figure out how many books they wanted to sell. And they mm-hmm. did a thing which is called they crashed the book,
okay.
which typically it takes 9 months between when a book appears in a catalog to when it appears on a shelf.
Sure, yeah.
And by crashing the book, they sent out like a flurry of faxes, apparently, to all the bookstores saying, you know, this is breaking right,
right
now.
Look out.
You know, get on this train or don't.
Yeah.
And so people at Borders and Barnes & Noble and Chapters here in Canada and, you know, the different chains were like, okay, yeah, let's do it. Let's get on board.
Right. And it got there in time for Christmas.
And it got there barely, like December, like the first week of December, which is kind of late for Christmas.
We got the last minute shoppers.
Yeah, we got some last minute shoppers. And then the real, you know, it was fully in there like in January.
Right, right.
Anyway, so we were like, we did it. Like, we crossed this crazy threshold. And then before we got any money from that, we got the notification that you won't be seeing most of this money because Borders has filed for bankruptcy.
Right.
And it was like, oh, well, that was crappy.
Yeah.
And it was like one of those weird fluke things that our once-in-a-lifetime thing intersected with their once-in-a-lifetime thing, and they kind of canceled each other out.
But it's to me, it's not like a total coincidence in that, like, what you did with the different type of model was so needed. And this old model. Antiquated system is also kind of collapsing.
I mean, I think there's also another way to look at it, which is Borders' willingness to spend money willy-nilly on some stupid thing from internet guys led to their downfall as a company.
So
I think that's less likely, but I'll throw that as an option.
And then we took their last couple bucks.
Right. There you go. Yeah, I think it's cool that you do talk about it as self-publishing, although it'd be easy to sort of say, hey, we run this. This small press, and we're running it together.
That's what you call it, right? Like, it's, I mean, sort of tangentially, when Dave and I talk about people who meet us and say, what do you do if you've just met them? You can say, I'm a cartoonist. You can say, I run a publishing company. You can say, I'm a self-published author. I'm an entrepreneur. Like, there's, you sort of pick the label depending on how interesting you want to be to the person talking to them. They look, if you don't want to talk to these people, you can just say, you know, I do comics. And generally, unfortunately, people go, oh, like Garfield, and you can say, kind of, and then the conversation is over.
Or you can say, I own a publishing company.
Right.
Which is true as well.
Yes.
And is, you know, it's a little bit more impressive.
Right. Yeah.
As you get into your 30s, you don't have to be a schlub anymore. You can be a professional.
Right.
I'm a professional cartoonist.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I'm fascinated by that whole dance as well, the social kind of like, what do you do? And I'm a novelist. Are you published? Yes, I am.
People don't get publishing, right? Like, they think publishing means you're Stephen King, and everyone who's published a book is living off their book. Well, the vast majority, I mean, my impression anyway, is that you publish a book, and, you know, if you're lucky, you make above what your advance was.
Right.
If you're lucky,
lucky. And, like, somehow publishing has this reputation as being this way to be set for life, and it's not that way.
No, I live it. But but
we all do.
Yeah, but the thing is like, I think what people are trying to suss out is, are you a real author that I should be impressed with, making a living doing that, or are you just a hobbyist who, like my cousin also is a hobbyist, and therefore I'm not.
Yeah.
That level of sort of excitement is
yeah, but maybe this cousin writes awesome books. That,
for sure. Like yeah, but people don't like to. I feel
they
like
want to waste their time.
Well, I feel like people don't like to make a call on their own. They like to have like a filter system that says like, I don't want to read everything. I don't want to decide if this is good or this guy is interesting on like what he.
I mean,
talks
bookstores
about.
Act as that arbiter of taste, kind of where. Yeah. There are people who, once we, you know, put the book in bookstores, like, wow, this is real. And like, it was real, you know, when we put the books together. Nothing's changed about the book.
Right.
Except that some gatekeeper that it's a physical thing that everyone can look at and say, oh, not everyone can do that, but you did. So that it gives you some benefit in your mind,
I suppose.
But it's also interesting because, I mean, we could call ourselves a small press as well. But that involves a lot of, like, so will you publish my gardening book that I'm working on?
Exactly.
You know, it's like, that leads to conversations that don't end well for anybody.
No. Yeah, and that's not what you're...
That's not what we're after.
You're about, yeah. So, getting back to that idea of, like, okay, so you had, you know, and I also think it's really interesting that you, the way that you tell the story in terms of, like, hey, we exhausted all possible options.
Yeah.
And... you know, then we did it our way and it was hugely successful. So there's this kind of, you know, kind of shows the kind of, in some ways, the flaws, say, in this sort of traditional publishing kind of mechanisms on some level.
Yeah. I mean, we're one data point among many.
Sure.
You know, we're really resistant to being held up as the example of how things should be done.
Right.
Because we have a really rarefied position in the internet sort of sphere and everything else. And this is a weird fluke project and so on.
And Glenn Beck.
And yeah, and that I mean, that whole thing, which is where we beat Glenn Beck's book to number one on our release day, and he took the trouble to call us out the following
day.
On his
show the next day.
On his radio show, calling us part of the liberal culture of death that's destroying America.
We didn't plan for that.
No, we couldn't have.
Seriously, how, like, did you send him the check before?
Actually, his producers emailed us.
Yeah, they're like, can you send us two review copies of the book?
Yeah.
And I wrote a nice letter back.
This is after we launched it.
Afterwards. Because everyone on Twitter took this story, and I'm sure the Glenn Beck people got wind of it.
Sure.
And so I don't know what they were after, but the cover letter I sent with the books was like, I'm sure Mr. Beck's audience would be very pleased to learn about these young entrepreneurs living the American dream. And
yeah, putting it in the right wing sort of.
Sure.
And
pull yourself up by your bootstraps. This is what we did. Why
right,
are you turning
us down? Yeah, we defeated the multimillionaire, you know. We defeated the man by being clever.
Right.
And I think what, I mean, if I can't say what they thought of it or if they even opened the book, but I don't think we were as easy to demonize as maybe they would have liked, so we never got mentioned again.
Right, right. Someone probably skimmed it or looked through it and said, oh, there's no good quotes.
Yeah, well, I'm sure, I mean, the whole reason that, again, I can't speculate, but if I were to speculate, the reason that he got mad was not just because, well, I mean, it was an ego thing, of course, but he wanted to rally his audience to right this wrong.
Right.
And if the facts of the situation were that we were not really a villain, then
right.
it doesn't fit the narrative.
Yeah,
so right, this right. doesn't worth not bringing up again.
Sure, sure. You served your purpose, and now yeah.
But we have what's kind of an irrepeatable success.
Okay.
However, just because someone with their book on gardening for dogs probably can't do it the same way we did, doesn't mean that we were strictly lucky. We worked for this because we have established over the past 8 years this sort of online following and this network of fellow colleagues in the industry. So it's not that it was random that it happened to us. It's just, you know, we did this.
We can't give you a checklist of things to do.
We can't give you a checklist
Amazon
of things to do.
But we got emails, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
So after saying, hey, how did you hack Amazon?
Right.
Right.
I want to buy this secret so I can get my...
Right. But kind of truthfully, insulting. Every traditional success of like someone who becomes super huge, I mean that also is like a number of like happy circumstances got them to that point. It's not formulaic either.
Right. Yeah. Overnight successes take 10 years.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That kind of idea.
Yeah.
We did it in 5.
We did. It in 5. Yeah.
So yeah. So I mean I guess like I have. This feeling, I mean, I work with the indie games community in Toronto, and working with that community as opposed to, say, the indie publishing community has been, or publishing world in general, has been, like, pretty intense because I sort of liken sort of publishing the publishing world to almost like dirt scrabble farmers. Mm-hmm. That if you come to them with your book or a new idea or a new model, they're like, we just got this carrot and this potato by working all year long. Like, don't try to screw it up. Like, we're barely sort of scraping by.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, like, the game world is almost like California or something, where, like, you throw down ideas, boom, just it comes up like crazy. So so for me, like, partially the kind of problem that people have with the publishing industry, or the kind of problem I have with them, say, demonizing the publishing industry as being a certain, you know, gatekeepers or whatever. I feel like it's such a subsistence existence. Mm-hmm. And they're proud people that have done it for generations this way. And the idea of, like, young upstarts coming up and just saying, hey, it's easy to do this. Or, you know, it drives them mental. So I think, so I'm interested in knowing, like, given that, I mean, you both, you know, sort of like tried to do it the right way and then kind of achieved success despite sort of like not having anything, any success that way. What some of the sort of like traditional publishing kind of responses have been?
I mean, one of the things that helped us was one of the people came back and said, this would be easier to sell if you had pictures. Uh-huh. And we're like, that's a great idea. Yeah. Right, we know these cartoonists. We are cartoonists. We should commission our friends to draw pictures for the book.
Right. Yeah.
And that worked out great. After we had the pictures, they still passed. Said no, not for us.
Yeah. Yes. In fact, that particular agent left agenting.
Okay, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah, and so that was another thing where we have a built-in advantage that maybe some of the people don't, which is that we know a lot of cartoonists, some of whom are extremely popular, mm-hmm. and all of whom are very talented. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to approach them in a very convenient way and say, would you like to be a part of this project? And we have, you know, we have a friendship that's existing where they can say, sure, you know, mm-hmm. I'll get on board with what you guys are doing. And, you know, we paid market rates and everything else, so we weren't asking for favors. And so when the book came out, this campaign of let's all band together and buy the book and promote it and everything, those cartoonists and their existing fan bases became part of that effort.
Right.
Which was extraordinarily helpful.
Right, right.
And it made the people who pay attention to webcomics as a sort of a sphere, which, you know, there's a lot of them, so it made them feel like this is coming at me from every direction today. Right. And I am going to miss out on this thing if I don't see what it's about.
Right.
And so that response has been sort of, it was an additive thing that made it much more like pervasive mm-hmm, for the fandom, which is, you know, it only helped us.
Right.
And so that was really cool.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, the way you've done this sort of talent show thing a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, the talent show was super fun.
Mm-hmm.
That was a thing where, like, we've been super gratified. I mean, not just because we've sold, you know, a couple books, but because the people who have bought the book or read it or downloaded our free PDF or listened to our free podcast or somehow even just read our blog post and experienced this in some way, people have taken ownership of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing you always want to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, we can't even hardly take credit for it. It's because people fall in love with the stories in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And these authors who have contributed wonderful worlds that people get lost in. And, you know, when we first started getting reviews of the book, very early on after the Amazon thing, where people were like, okay, these guys did a stunt, but how good is the book really?
Yeah.
It's actually great.
Yeah.
Like, that was the most gratifying thing. Because we got to say, we were right all along. We believed in this thing, and now you know why.
Because it's not just a gimmick.
It's not just a gimmick, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that's going to give it staying power, if anything. You know, mm-hmm. It's not just a flash in the pan. So the fact that people fell in love with the book, and so much so that they were sort of wanting to inhabit the world of it, is something that we wanted to encourage.
Right.
Of course. And, again, because we sort of do webcomics and we go to these conventions and we see how fandoms can grow mm-hmm. around properties, and Ryan has a comic strip where he's got three characters, and he's probably made 20 products with the one pose of T-Rex in the same pose every single time, because that's all there is.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You can just iterate that mm-hmm. in interesting ways, and people are still really into it.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of taking that model and adapting it to, okay, we have a book, one product, and if you've bought it, you've bought everything.
Mm-hmm.
What else can we do?
Mm-hmm.
And that is, and one of the things that suggested was, in a very roundabout way, a talent show. Because I wanted to hold a book signing, because we never got a chance to do a release party or anything.
Right, right, right.
I wanted to hold a book signing, and I was like, who would come to a book signing if there wasn't entertainment?
Right, okay.
And then I thought, what kind of entertainment can we have? Why not do the same thing we did with the book and just ask people to create things?
Right.
And so we got musicians, and we got, you know, sketch comedy, and we got people doing monologues, and we got,
animation.
People doing animations, mm-hmm. sent us a video, doing live action sketches. I rented a theater in Hollywood, and we had a cake, and we got, you know, drinks, and we invited, and it was free admission.
Yeah, yeah. Great.
And we just wanted to put on a show. And,
we
put it online, we streamed it, we played Pictionary. Like, it was, like, we packed the house.
Yeah, yeah.
It was standing room only. It was amazing
see.
And this is sort of following the less talk, more rock thing.
Yes.
Yeah,
just do it. It seems like it'd be a cool thing to do.
Yeah. Because it seems like it'd be fun. That's all. And we lost money on it, but it was just super fun.
Right, right.
And we gained people feeling like these guys are part of something amazing.
Right.
And now
there's a real world kind of like event.
Yeah, and we got emails from people. Like, there's this one girl in particular. She's like, I just moved to L.A., I'm going to grad school here. I hate being away from my family. I felt so like alienated from this city, and I got to be part of this amazing creative thing for one night. Awesome. And I start to feel like, you know, finally, here's a place I belong.
Right.
After being away from everything I'm used to.
Great.
And things like that. That's what we want. We want people to feel excited about the world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, not to do another boring reading series, like, you know, of like the typical kind of, okay, people up on the stage and doing a reading.
And that's fine. But yeah, but we're, I mean, and we had that too as part of the show.
As part of it, though, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, it can't, if it's the, if it's one after the other, it's the suicide story again and again and again.
Yeah.
It's like the monotony of it is like, okay, let's accept that we need something more than like this kind of broken performance idea of the reading.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah, we're looking for things that excite us too.
Yeah, yeah. What would you want to go to and
exactly.
then do it?
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome.
And then that ties in with the idea of I can't do anything unless it's super complicated.
Right.
And so it's like when I had the idea for the talent show, it's like, I'll do this, but only if it's incredibly complex. And then it turned out that that's what made it awesome.
Right, right. Cool.
So,
cool.
But there's actually one other thing that I wanted to bring up, too, and that's the idea of we, with regard to traditional publishing,
mm-hmm.
We don't know anything about traditional publishing. In fact, you know, we've done this stuff in bookstores and so far, and that's been the least successful part of our entire enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been great. It's been fun. It's mm-hmm. been great to walk into a bookstore and see your book on the shelf. We went today to, what was the name of the bookstore?
World's Biggest Bookstore.
World's Biggest
and they had 24 copies. They're like, hey, we edited this book. Can we sign them? And the lady was really suspicious initially.
Yeah.
She's like, so both of you did the book? And then she picks up the book. She looks for author photos, and there were none. She's like, well... But she brought the books out, and we signed them. While we were signing, we were telling her the story of the book, and she was really interested. And
She got super into it. She's like, oh, well, this is cool.
Yeah.
You know, we make an ally at this bookstore who
sure.
happens to have 24 signed copies of the book right
That's
next
right.
to her.
Unreturnable.
Unreturnable. Yeah, they
That's
put
what
stickers
I like
on
sign in them. Yeah.
And they, I mean, and they took something off the new science fiction shelf and put our book on, face out.
Sure.
Which is like, you know, yeah, we love that. It's amazing.
Yeah, sure, sure.
And hopefully that's going to get the book into the hands of more people than it otherwise would.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I mean about the hybrid approach, where it's like, if we only did that, I don't think we'd ever make our money back.
Right.
But the fact that we are incorporating that as part of it only serves to broaden our audience.
And we're not relying on someone else to go out and sell the books.
Right.
Right.
Like, if we're in the town, might as well.
Yeah.
Go
and sell the books.
Go check it out.
So, so we don't know anything about publishing. And what we do know about, however, is... like doing interesting things on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan is a programmer,
mm-hmm.
and I'm a designer,
mm-hmm.
and our friend Matt works in marketing. And we are kind of everything except authors.
Mm-hmm.
And we, in fact, the only thing that we didn't do ourselves was write the book.
Mm-hmm.
We outsourced that part of it. So we're much closer to like product designers, but the product was a book.
Right, right.
You know, because Ryan and I both...
We produced it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we also wrote stories for
it. Yeah, we wrote stories for it, too.
The majority of the story.
Right, right.
You know, and we're, you know, we're proud of the sort of curatorial eye that we put into it, but, you know, Ryan and I both make our livings, or part of it at least, by designing t-shirts and posters and weird products like mugs and, you know, calendars and things like
stuffed
that.
Animals.
Stuffed animals. And magnets and just, you know, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just put that same, like, what can we make that people will like hat on?
Mm-hmm.
And we just ended up making a book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's the thing that we know how to make. And I guess publishing, the industry of publishing also does that, and we don't care about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine, but that's not what we know about, so that's not what we did.
Mm-hmm.
What
mm-hmm.
we did was the thing that we know about. And
right.
It seems that it worked out.
Right, right. And now you've got a second one kind of in the works?
Yeah,
yeah, opened the submissions
things? Like a week ago.
A week ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So through
got
July.
About 50 so far.
Yeah,
okay.
Through July 15th.
Wow.
People are invited to write stories on the same premise,
because
we feel like there's still some meat on that bone, and we wanted to say, we've all read the first book, what didn't we cover? Write something else.
What are the stories you wish were in there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the things you're doing differently? Are you publishing it yourself again?
Yeah, we're going to do the self-publishing again.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things we're doing differently are... just for the sake of trying it, now that we have this like road and this conduit into the bookstore machine, we're going to try and release the book normally.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to do a day and date release at, in bookstores, and we're going to try and send out advanced copies for reviews, mm-hmm. which we never did. We're going to try and get, you know, some press around the release of it, which we never did.
And this is all experiments. Like, sure. We've got this chance to see how can this work. We've all done the self-publishing thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've got this chance. What difference does it make when mm-hmm. you have the book in bookstores? How exactly. many different copies do you sell? What does it mean if you're having the book out online the same day that's in the store?
Yeah.
It's our opportunity to learn about that. Because sure. because we don't know about publishing, I mean, let's try it that way and just see, you know, what difference does it make?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that's pretty awesome about the project is all the numbers and graphs and whatnot.
And sharing the results.
And yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's coming up in the third one or not, but I'm interested in, like, units moved and dollars made and all mm-hmm. those types of things. I don't know if you've decided to sort of mention those things or not, or...
Well, I've actually had some people... There's this whole community, almost a subculture online, of people selling ebooks
mm-hmm.
and trying to make money with that. And right. around that, there's this community of people trying to make money, telling you how to make money, selling yes. ebooks.
Yeah.
And so we've kind of accidentally waded into that by mm-hmm. having this website where it's like, we put out this book, there's an ebook of it, here's the results, here's the numbers, blah, blah, blah. And there's been some, like, suspicion.
I mean, there's always people who are like, you know, they gamed the system or their successes are not what they claim they are. There's mm-hmm. always going to be people who are looking to duplicate your thing. In fact, there's mm-hmm. a guy who's got an anthology yep. that he's accepting submissions for, and he's like, here's what we're going to do. Just like Machine of Death, we're going to have everyone buy it on Amazon, and then everyone's going to love it, and then we're going to become number one, and it's downhill from there. And he actually said that, and it's like, I mean, I kind of liken it to fighting terrorism, where you can't just mirror the last big thing, you have to just think differently all the time.
Sure.
And so our challenge is, you know, we can't do the Amazon thing again,
right.
we don't think, especially if we're going to be in bookstores. So what are we going to do differently, and you know, we don't know what the next kind of stunt or how to get people excited about it mm-hmm. necessarily will be. But with regard to the numbers in particular, it's tricky because it's kind of like asking your friend what his salary is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a discomfort where it colors the whole conversation and people's jealousies start to come out in ways that they can't control.
Right.
If you're more successful than them, then they get bitter. And if you're less successful than them, they think you have nothing worthwhile to add.
Yeah.
And so we decided that there's not a lot to be gained from that.
Mm-hmm.
And people can just kind of take, like, we're more interested in relative values.
Yeah.
You know, trends. Yeah, ebook mm-hmm. versus print. Mm-hmm. Yeah, trends. We sold this many, you know, this bar graph in January versus this bar graph in March.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's the thing that we think the real meat is, because the physical numbers are going to be so different for everybody anyway.
Right.
It's almost not worth talking about.
Yeah.
In our opinion.
Yeah. No. That's. I mean. I think partially one of the reasons I like to do it is because it kind of. It's just I like being contrary with that particular social
sure.
stigma attached
sure,
with
sure.
sharing the. You know.
Yeah,
so
right,
so
fine.
I'm like, yeah, I made $10,000 on this, and
yeah.
I, you know, but I totally understand if. For those reasons, it's...
Yeah. I mean,
well,
and there's a lot of the ebook people who are like, they like to cite the numbers because they are impressive. And
right.
that's great because their business is telling people, you can do it, and here's proof.
Right.
You know, this is not chump change.
Sure.
And that's totally fair. And
yeah.
that's totally great. And in our case, we don't need to prove anything.
Right.
We don't feel like we need to prove anything.
Right.
And so the conversation doesn't need to be about that, as far as we're concerned.
The specific numbers. No, and what I felt coloring the whole discussion around the ebook stuff, obviously, there's a huge, because I started giving away in 2000. I've seen,
yeah,
like,
you were way out of the curve.
I've just heard, like, a lot of BS around it. People telling me, oh, you're hurting your sales. I'm like, no, this is promotion.
Yeah.
This is
mm-hmm.
a promotional
yeah.
item.
Can't tell many people who walk up to us saying, I started reading the PDF and I loved it.
Yeah.
And here I am, buy the book.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
yeah.
And, like, my favorite story is I did a show in Lancaster in the UK, one of the best shows I've done. It had, like, you know, a punk band sort of opening, and then this someone else sort of doing comedy, and then I did my shtick with everyone in Silico book and killed, loved it, crowd full of, you know, it was awesome. It was
cool,
a really
yeah.
awesome, you know, like coming into a city, you don't know And then, you know, it was a fantastic time. And then afterwards, after we'd sold, you know, I think we sold 20 books or something like that. And the organizer picks up the book and goes, oh, that's what the cover looks like. And I said, you've never seen the cover? And she goes, no, I got it as an RTF file or whatever.
Right.
I started thinking about that, which is that I lost one sale, made 20 sales, just on a perfectly sort of capitalist point of view. But on a secondary level, it's sort of like the kind of community you can build around that and the people that you can connect with. Like, I don't buy a lot of stuff, but I do a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So, like, and in that case, that particular person, like, she would never have been exposed to my work because she doesn't buy anything. Yeah. But she has lots of time. She could organize, say, an event like this. Yeah. And so it's these weird kind of exchanges that aren't really sort of discussed. Or
the way we put it is that, at the end of the day, we think these are really great stories and we'd like you to read them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it would suck to have this paywall between you and that when it doesn't have to be that way.
Right. Yeah.
And it also helps when you're trying to do, like, oh, coming out of this Machine of Death talent show, what's it about? Here's the PDF, read the book. You don't have to send them out to a bookstore or say, tell me $10 and then you'll know.
Yes.
It's hard to build a community based on giving me money first to buy in. Like, that's almost...
Yeah. We feel like you have to make people aware of the work before you can ever make them fans of the work. Mm-hmm. So the fewer barriers you can put in that process, the better.
Yeah.
And, the reason to make money is just... I mean, it's purely... logistical.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pay your rent, you have to print the books that you're selling, you have to, you know, live in this world and pay your phone bill. Like, but in a perfect world, we just want to do cool things that people can share.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we start there, we have to trust that the logistics will follow.
Mm-hmm.
And people, the goodwill that's engendered, you know, will come back to us in a way that makes the enterprise sustainable.
So
far that's been borne out.
And that's a different kind of way of thinking than a traditional publisher, because you guys are so personally invested in each project you put out.
Yeah.
Because something you put out now, you might, you know, reap karmic rewards 5 years from now. Whereas if a publisher is doing the same thing, each project they're doing is very different.
Yeah.
Like, and they're not personally involved with it. So it means that, like, why would I want to give away an ebook that I could sell?
Yeah.
Like, you know, so the mentality in that kind of owner-operator kind of
No one else cares as much about your work as you do.
Right.
Is how it goes. Yeah, when you're a profit-making corporation, and, you know, we don't want to lose money necessarily, but none of our mortgages are writing on this book in particular, and so we can take experiments and risks that maybe not everyone would be willing to.
Right.
For the sake of seeing what it would be like.
Yeah.
And then sharing
the
results with everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, and that sort of experimentalism with, the ebook stuff. I mean, so the stuff I've seen is that kind of predatory, kind of like, buy my ebook and you'll find out how to make money with your books, you know?
Right, yeah.
And, you know, there's that. There's also the interminable publishing industry panels where a bunch of traditional publishing people sit around and kind of... wring their hands about, like, well, we could do this with the ebook format, but you can tell they don't want to. It really, like, it colors that whole kind of that whole discussion that the publishing world has about it, which is that we have to deal with this.
It's not an opportunity, it's a problem that needs to be dealt with.
It's a problem that they want to try to hook up with their traditional kind of model, which is, you know, understandable. And I feel like, in general, probably the types of people that are attracted to the publishing world and, say, like, more traditional media are more traditional people. It kind of makes sense on some levels. I mean, I always love books, but I also love games and like, all sorts of new different things. So, you know, and it's interesting to see, like, with you guys being web people first and sort of, like...
stumbling into print.
or just, like, kind of, like, taking inspiration from, like, Craig's thing, or like on Let's Talk More Rock, or, you know, like because I feel like that is something that a traditional publishing person wouldn't reference. Like, it would just be like, well, they're the enemy, so let's let's focus on, like,
shore up our position.
Our
driving principle, if we have one, is let's make cool things.
Mm-hmm.
That's all there is. And then, if hopefully we make it so that we don't you know, bankrupt himself doing it. But right. that's, you know, we just have to trust that our instincts are good enough that we'll make it work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, like, yeah, I mean, I feel like the success or the finances around those things, if they break even or make some money or whatever, it's almost kind of people's way of placing it on a spectrum of, like, success.
It's an easy, people have numbers, right? And it's right. a really easy thing to point to. We're trying to compare it to products that are dissimilar, mm-hmm. how much profit they made, there's your reference thing.
Right, right.
And that's really good for marketing, for measuring things by how much money they made, but it's not the best tool for measuring how good they are.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I mean, you guys have very clear compasses in what is good. And I, my experience with the publishing world has shown me that, like, the editor, for instance, who was at some point brought me in, was fired, and then I was put with another editor, and I got through conversations from her that, like, she was, she thought what I did was cool because she knew three or four people, young people at the publishing company who liked my book.
Right.
So it wasn't her taste that she was championing. It was almost like the people around her.
Yeah.
And I feel like that people's, like, the idea of having taste, good taste, bad taste, whatever, just a strong preference in sort of aesthetics or kind of art or culture or whatever is actually unusual. Like, and there's lots of people who don't have it. And for those people who don't have it, there are numbers,
yeah.
You know, and you know, and that's a way to kind of, like,
yeah.
to put something, it's a metric, right?
I think what made it easy for us is that there was just three of us making all the decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so we weren't in this unit of a large corporation where we can say this is great,
right?
We had, and we're gonna do it this way. We had no one else to tell us you can't do it this way.
Right. We didn't have to justify it to anybody. And right. I think three is a good number because
one, no ties.
Well, I mean,
and you can call yourself a triumvirate too.
It's great.
But
word.
Like one person working by themselves can sometimes be crippling. Sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's helpful to have someone to bounce an idea off of who has a different perspective. And you know, you get up to, you know, three people, you've got sort of different enough perspectives that the thing stays interesting without being cripplingly difficult to
right.
get anyone to agree on anything.
Yeah.
So I think that's worked out for this project very well. And I also, I think with regard to having taste, people are afraid of being wrong.
Okay.
People are afraid of being outed as dorks for liking something that
okay.
is dumb.
Okay.
And so they're afraid to take a stand and say, you know what, I like this. Because everyone else is going to say, you like that, you have bad taste.
Right, right.
And so they just go, well, I like the popular thing.
Yeah.
And the popular thing, then they watch the popular thing and they're like, this is fine. No, I like this, it's fine.
And this will do.
Yeah.
I can deal with this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, not everyone is like that. But I think that is the easy out.
Right, right.
And so that's where something being popular becomes a tribal marker,
mm-hmm.
where it's like, oh, we can share a conversation about XYZ because we have both seen it, and
right.
now we can bond. We can use it as a surrogate to bond,
right?
Which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And Machine of Death has served that purpose for some people,
mm-hmm.
Which is great to see as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's also something really cool about discovering something, realizing it's awesome, and being the guy or the girl who found it and can champion it to your friends.
Right.
And some people, the people who take the joy in that are the people who are seeking us out and that we're working to serve.
It's mm-hmm. also great to have friends who are like that. I mean, I like music, but I don't really seek out that much music. I don't have time or everything of it, but
mm-hmm.
my buddy Keen has terrific taste in music that messes up with mine really well, and I'll
mm-hmm.
ask him occasionally, like, what are you listening to?
Right.
Where can I get some sweet new beats from? And it's sort of almost like he's the music specialist, and I
right.
think we've optimized our community by him focusing on that. No, I don't have to farm anymore because he's taking care of the farming.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'll just trade him for that.
Excellent. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So just, yeah, did you guys have any sort of final comments, thoughts?
I think people should write stories for Machine of Death too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been super cool to see that one of the most common questions that we got after the book was released and read was, how can there be more of this?
Right.
You know, so
I didn't hear about this, which is fair because the call for submissions was years in the past at that point. Like, I wish I knew about this. I'd love to write a story.
Yeah. And so after sort of a lot of conversation about what our next step could be, we decided that, you know, the easy thing to do is just do it again.
Right, right.
So we have...
And tell different stories.
And tell different stories. And yeah, and see if we can plumb a little bit deeper.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to put out another book that's going to be out next year, but through July 15th, 2011, the Submission period is open, both for writers and for illustrators who would like to be considered for the second volume. And the details are on our website, machineofdeath.net, and you can submit a story that you write. It's totally free to submit, open to everybody, no prejudice. We're hoping to get stories from around the world, people of all different ages, skill levels, backgrounds. You can also read the last book. You can go to the website, you can download our free PDF, or you can find out how to get a print copy, or a Kindle copy, or a EPUB, or whatever you like. And, you know, see what you think. And if you like it, you know, there's all kinds of cool folks who are happy to be involved, and we want to make it easy for people to continue to participate if they wish.
Right on. Okay, thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.